I'm Jana Marin, and you're listening to More to the Story, the podcast that's all about creative nonfiction and the power of sharing your personal story.
Tell me a story. Tell me true. I want to know what happened to you. The stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell mine to you.
Welcome to episode number 4 of More to the Story, a show that is all about something near and dear to my heart, telling true stories and sharing them with the world. In addition to this podcast, I also publish a literary magazine called Under the Gum Tree, which is dedicated to creative nonfiction and visual art. The magazine is published quarterly in digital and print, and if you enjoy the readings on this show, I encourage you to check out the complete stories by purchasing a single issue or getting a subscription. Your purchase directly supports the work of the writers and artists we publish. Digital subscriptions are $2 a month, and print subscriptions are $7 a month. All of that info is online at underthegumtree.com. On today's episode of More to the Story, I'm joined by Samuel Ottman, one of Under the Gumtree's previous contributors. Samuel is a member of DePauw University's writing faculty in Greencastle, Indiana, where he specializes in the personal essay. One of his essays, Invisible Nails, won first place in the SLS Disquiet 2015 Literary Contest in the nonfiction category. His work has also appeared in the Chalk Circle Prize-winning Intercultural Essays, Black Gay Genius Answering Joseph Beam's Call, Ninth Letter, The Common Reader, Brevity, I'm Black and I Travel, The Huffington Post, and The Good Man Project. He's currently at work on Sanctified, a memoir, which we talk about in the interview. His essay, The Tongues of Angels, appears in issue 7 of Under the Gum Tree, published in April 2013. Before we get to the interview, here is Samuel reading from a piece entitled Disappearing on the Delta.
I'm standing outside my grandparents' house in Grady, Arkansas, a town of 523 souls on the Mississippi Delta. My sister and I spent our summers running around barefoot on these dirt roads as children. Our grandmother sometimes locked us kids out of the house as she sat at a sewing machine eating ice cream with an electric fan blowing on her. "Chillin' belongs outside," she'd yell to us as we all had our faces pressed against the screen door. Clouds dance on the pink horizon as the sun sets over the green and white wooden house my grandfather built in 1960. I'm 5 hours late, having flown from New York City. I haven't stayed the night at their house in 25 years. I've come to see Madea, 87, and Granddaddy, 90, before one or both of them dies. I want her to hug me, to give me a hot tea or wrap one of her homemade quilts around me. Just maybe age has softened her. I slam the rental trunk shut, compose myself, and knock on the door. They yell for me to come in. Madea rests on her recliner while Granddaddy sprawls out on the sofa. The audience cheers on the Wheel of Fortune. I stoop my 6'4" frame to hug them. Vanna White turns a consonant around. The woman on TV picks the wrong word. Granddaddy sits back and radiates in the silence. "Now, boy, how come you is so late?" Madea spits out, clutching the TV remote. "Oh, I overslept. I missed a flight. I had to take a later one." "Overslept? Well, if you had had a woman in your life, you wouldn't have overslept. The woman would have woke you up, and you wouldn't have missed your flight." I smile at Madea, her once bovine frame bent over with what my mother called an old folks hump, the deformity so pronounced that she needs a walker to prop herself up. Moles the size of raisins and chocolate chips populate her face. The same moles have begun to appear on my mother's skin. The eyeglasses sit cockeyed on her face. She looks like a little girl. Madea reaches down, spits in an old, torn-up Clorox bleach bottle crammed with paper towels stained with brown spittle. I grimace and swallow before mumbling, "Yes, ma'am." "Now, child, how come you ain't married?" "Well, I guess I just haven't met the right one." Listen, I want you to find a woman, any woman, marry her for 2 weeks and then get a divorce. I want you to be able to wake up, I want you to know what it's like to wake up next to a woman, any woman, okay? Mundia knows that a 40-year-old man who has never mentioned women or brought home a girlfriend isn't into women. The things I want to say, I can't. My mother would never forgive me. I force a smile. My grandmother will never change. I'm still the kid with his face against the window looking inside. My grandparents lived in Lincoln County all their lives. Cotton gins and John Deere tractors littered the landscape. Sunflowers, hogweeds, and dandelions grow aplenty. Cotton, rice, and soybean fields claim more than 3/4 of Grady's land, an atmosphere where rats and snakes thrive. The swampy summers are filled with lots of thunderstorms and flash floods. Even after the many years of slavery and sharecropping ended, whites still owned most of the big farms. In Arkansas, just like Mississippi, Missouri, and Louisiana, the life of the state once depended on the industry that came floating along the river, except no major rivers flow through Grady. There are two bayous, Deep Bayou, a small waterhole where people still get baptized by full immersion, and the Bartholomew Bayou, which is the biggest bayou in the United States. It flows northwest from Pine Bluff on for 359 miles south, crossing the Louisiana border, connecting to the Ouachita River. But when Mudit talks about the bayou, she means the Bartholomew Bayou, because more folks drowned in that one. As the crow flies, Grady is 220 miles south and east of Pine Bluff in the middle of Lincoln County. From US 65 Highway, it was once a clean shot. Around 2009, the federal government extended Interstate 530, effectively cutting Grady off from any traffic now. All the stores, even the gas station, closed. Grady hovers at Death Ridge, but won't cross over. Most of my cousins that I ran around with as kids have moved away. My granddaddy took his last breath in 2011 at 94. A few months before Madea turned 94, a stroke forced her to move into Little Rock with relatives. She died last year, also at 94. The Grady I once knew has become a memory.
Thank you, Samuel, and welcome to More to the Story. It's so great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's get started with a little bit about your writing background and in particular how you found the creative nonfiction genre.
Okay. So I was interested in being a newspaper reporter from childhood. And so when I graduated from the University of Missouri School of Journalism, I got a job in Tulsa, Oklahoma, my first newspaper in 1989. And so from 1989 to 2002, I worked in Tulsa, Salt Lake City, St. Louis, and San Diego. And so once the terrorist attacks happened in 2001, I kind of lost interest in newspapers because it all became really sad. But in the interim, I got to write a lot. I developed an interest in narrative writing. And what happened was my family life became worthy of stories that I wrote for the newspaper. And I won a couple of awards for narrative pieces I wrote about my father and his subsequent death. So that really became the impetus for me to get into nonfiction.
And how long have you been writing narrative nonfiction now?
Well, I guess it depends on when you want to count. I would say I started effectively in about 2000, 2001. I began to write really seriously longer form nonfiction pieces for the newspaper. Then right after that, I left and I went and got my MFA in Columbia University in New York City. So I've been really doing it pretty seriously since then.
Okay. And one thing that I'm always curious about, there's another writer from Under the Gum Tree who I interviewed for this podcast who was also formerly a journalist before he started pursuing creative nonfiction. And I love this idea of that transition from like fact-based writing to writing that is still based in truth, but it's more subjective than the aim of journalistic writing. So what's that transition been like for you?
You know, I have to say it's been a really, really bumpy one, because my training from the University of Missouri School of Journalism was to keep myself out of the stories.
Right.
It was all very fact-based. You don't want to reveal any bias. I remember when I was working in Tulsa, I covered the Tulsa County political campaigns, and we would actually count to make sure that the Democrats and Republicans got the same number of paragraphs in every story.
Well, that's one way to do it, right?
Well,
you were saying...
you were talking about my transition. So it was really bumpy, because I had been so trained by journalism schools to keep myself out of the story. But at the same time, after my father died, I began to write pieces that were more narrative and more personal. And so I began to slowly ease into more narrative style, which felt much more comfortable to me. And really, that is what ultimately led me out of newspapers, because I really loved the way the narrative stories felt. And I even after I left, it took me easily a decade to kind of shed some of the training I had as a journalist, to feel more comfortable putting my own voice and my feelings in pieces, because I've been so trained by journalism. And I still teach journalism, so I have two sides to my brain. There's the journalism side, fiction side, and I have to really, really balance them.
So do you find that there's any piece from journalism that informs your narrative writing, or vice versa?
Oh, absolutely. My ear for dialogue is completely informed by journalism. I mean, all my friends who are journalists, we know when we hear a good quote. Of course, now I call it dialogue. So I really like for dialogue to sparkle. I look for details that push the story forward. My ability to follow, I'm very deadline driven. And so one of the issues I've had in nonfiction is, you know, I'm working on a writing project, which I've been working on for about a decade. Well, because I don't have a publisher or a deadline, I can just kind of take my time and work on it and work on it. But once I know I have a deadline, then something else kicks in. And so that's from journalism. I know the power of a deadline. And so, yeah, so it's not all been bad. I've just had to learn to imbue my prose with feeling, which is counterintuitive to newspaper writing.
Right, exactly. So let's talk a little bit about the piece you read, Disappearing on the Delta.
Okay.
What was the impetus for you writing that piece?
So I was in graduate school in New York City. I had been there for about a semester, and I had always thought that my family in Arkansas, and of course they were really important to me, but I always felt that there was something richer than just my interest in it. And so when I got to school in New York City, I began to write about them, and people were just absolutely amazed by the stories I wrote from Arkansas. And so while I was in grad school, I went back to Arkansas to visit my grandparents. I thought, you know, these people are in their late 80s, early 90s. I should go visit them. And so that was really the impetus for that piece. I kind of wanted to sort of make peace with my memories of my grandmother. She was kind of a really difficult figure. And so I wanted to think, you know, is it just my memory of her being this bad, or was she really this difficult? So I wanted to go back to sleep.
She does come off as a bit of a difficult character in that piece, but in a comical way almost.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, and of course, you know, she recently died. And so it's like, wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of, you know, they live to be into their 90s. So I kind of, you know, you prepare, you're more prepared to lose relatives who are in their 90s than people who are younger than that. So I kind of was ready for it. But her loss really hit us all really hard, I have to say.
Sure. One of the things that really touched me, or not touched me, but I found really appreciated in that piece, the way you wrote it, was the subtlety around sexuality and your grandmother's pestering you to find a woman.
Right.
But you don't explicitly write about your sexuality. You just kind of, it's the subtlety and the things that are not said in the piece that let the reader kind of deduce what's going on there.
Well, you know, I've become really sensitive to it because I'm, you know, my memoir is about navigating sexuality and spirituality. And so because I'm a professor at a university, students can Google me, right? So they can go online and read all these things I write. So I become really, really aware of that what I write online stays online long after I'm gone. So I wanted to be very, very careful. And as I, the more I write online, the more careful I am. It's not that I'm ashamed of it, but I just wanted to have, I thought specifically in that piece, you know, since it was kind of unstated between she and I thought it would be important to have it be unstated in the piece.
Which I think works really well. I so appreciate the subtlety in writing like that.
Thank you.
Did that sexuality stay unstated between you and she until she passed? Did you ever come out to her?
Before she died? You know, we would talk about other relatives that she knew was gay, but she could never, you know, I think because, so the other thing that I was not able to say is she was beginning to experience some dementia at that point. So her mind was beginning to go. And so by the time she was in her 90s, her mind was almost entirely gone. And so there was never really a chance. And at this point, I thought, you know, I'm 46, 47, you know, why would I even bring this up now? Like, you know, she's living with other people in another part of the country. There's no point. I don't need to prove anything to her. You know, she's lived her life. I'm going to live mine. And I'll have my say on the page.
That's a really wise approach, I think.
Thank you.
There's I encounter a lot of writers who really stress out about writing things about family and personal things that are not known within family members and close people to them in their lives. And they stress out about it to this degree where it almost inhibits the writing process.
No, it has, I have to say, you know, so I'm working on something called Sanctified, a Memoir. It's about my journey as a gay man through the Pentecostal church. And there were many times where I tried to pray the gay away. I've had more experience with that than I would really want to admit publicly. But it's worth a memoir, though. And so I realized that some things are just between me and what's on the page, and other things are meant to be said face-to-face with other people. But as a person who is, I'm primarily an essayist who's moving into memoir, I feel that my commitment is to be honest about my feelings on the page without really demonizing people. And so I really try to imbue the piece I read with a bit of humor, because my grandmother was a really very comical person. I mean, she was hilarious, right? And so I think I've had to learn to not judge people, to let their actions speak and to let their behavior speak, and to not really comment on it from a point of view of judgment, to let what they do as characters speak. And then I can talk about my reaction to what they did, but to not really get so tortured about it. You know, and it's a journey. It's been a real journey. I mean, there are some really, really sensitive things I'm writing about. You know, that I have on my father's side of the family, I'm not really in touch with very many of them. And I think by the time the memoir comes out, I think some of them may not be very happy. But, you know, I'm just telling what I remember. And also, you know, you asked me earlier about having been a journalist. Well, the second chapter of the memoir took me a long time to write, because there was an incident with rodents in his house in Louisiana, and I had to kind of recreate it. It took me a long time. I had to do a lot of journaling, and you know, my parents' divorce. I had to get the police records. So because I'm a journalist by training, if people come to me and say, well, this isn't really true, well, in some cases I have the police records or the court records, so I have corroboration, so it's not just my memories. So I think that's where the journalism comes in really handy. So much of my memoir, because I was writing columns for most of my career as a journalist, much of it will be corroborated through columns that I wrote in the newspaper.
All right, that's really interesting. And so how long have you been working on your memoir?
Well, that's an interesting question, because, you know, it's not like I've been working on it every day for 10 years. When I was in graduate school, it really became very clear that I had some material, but it's taken me some time to grow into it, also into the boldness to write about really painful issues. Sometimes in grad school, I felt people were pushing me into say this or write it this way or make it do this. I had to really kind of let it marinate. I'm not in competition with anyone. So I had to kind of discover what it was I was trying to say. And so it's taken, I would say, at least a decade, at least a decade. And so I've had pieces online that have been representative of the memoir, but now I have a 110-page book proposal that, and an agent I'm working with in New York, and we're about to send it out. So it's taken me some time to kind of burn through issues of shame. And you know, my sister has schizophrenia. You know, my father died. I'm gay. So how does all that mold itself into a memoir without? What is the main point of the memoir? So it's been a great process, but it's also taking me some time. So I would say at least a decade. I'm working on probably my fourth draft of the book proposal, but each time it gets stronger and stronger.
So what is your process for distilling the focus of the memoir? That's a question that I think writers wrestle with anytime they approach writing about a life experience, because a life experience is so vast and it's really hard to kind of remove yourself from being subjectively immersed in it and to view it almost as an objective outsider, to like distill the thematic elements that really make a memoir stand on its own.
Oh, it's a really, really good question. And you have hit the central issue. So before I answer this, I was teaching full time. I subsequently got tenure. So I was keeping up with all my teaching responsibilities. I had all these other things I had to do. So the memoir was never really front and center. So I've been able to work on it on the side slowly. So I'll say I have a really, really good literary agent in New York who has been reading. When I was in grad school, I actually had an internship in her office where I read from her slush pile. So I got to read a lot of really great book proposals. And so she's been training me for the last decade, actually, on how to fine-tune this book proposal because she has really great aspirations for it. So the back and forth between she and I has been really, really helpful. She's a Jewish woman who's slightly older than I am, so her cultural lens is very different from mine. And so I have one of my relatives, my mother's sister, was a larger-than-life Pentecostal figure. Well, so, you know, I knew I loved, she's deceased now, and my agent would say, well, why is she in here? Why is she a part of this story? And so her asking me that made me really think, why am I writing about her? What am I saying about her? What did I think of her then? What do I think of her now? And why is she relevant? So over the last decade, I've seen a lot of really good book proposals. And I worked for a short time for a small press in New York City. And I worked for about 5 months at a boutique literary agency. So that experience also deeply informs what I'm doing. So I know to take my time. You have one shot with the big houses in New York City. So your message has to be really, really clear. And so I know now that my message is about what it means to be a gay person who is spiritual. That's what it's really about. It's not about Arkansas. My family is a part of it. But the whole journey is about my journey through Pentecostal churches and coming out on the other side, a spiritual person who may or may not have Pentecostal beliefs. And so, but it took me a long time to distill that, and a lot of drafts and, you know, people reading in workshop, what is this about? So it's taken me some time. And I think one of the difficulties with teaching undergraduates is they're 19 or 20 or 22, they don't have 50 years of looking back in context. And so I'm really grateful that I've had time and the ability to meditate on what it is I want to say. I can honestly say the proposal I have now is much stronger. The agent told me she thinks it's ready to go out now, but we're still doing some fine-tuning because she really has great aspirations for it. So, yeah, I've been lucky in that I've had time.
I think that's an important lesson for any and for writers of any age, I mean, young or old, just kind of letting your work, giving your work that time and space so that when you come back to it, you have a better, clearer understanding of what it is you're trying to get at.
It's a hard lesson to learn because, you know, we live in a social media is so instantaneous in our culture. Things that happen so quick, so fast. And so a book is counterintuitive to that. It takes years of, you know, I've easily written 400 or 500 pages. Probably only 100 pages are really worthwhile now. So I think that the time to distill, to let the false idea of what I thought it was versus what it really wants to be about come forward. And also, I don't want to just write a book. I want to write a really good book. And I want to write a book that has some cultural resonance. I want people to read it and say, wow, I've never known that. Or for them to say, I really recognize this. This is a voice and a point of view I've never heard on it, but this is really speaking to me. And so for it to be real, I think it takes some time. At least it's taking me time.
Now, this is going to be a little bit of a loaded question, but can you talk just a little bit about how did you end up at a place where you're comfortable with your past and your story? I mean, growing up a gay man in a Pentecostal church, that has to be hugely complicated, and there must have been a lot of internal conflict that you dealt with. Was it like for you to end up at a place you're okay with yourself and comfortable enough to now write and share this story?
You know, you're asking really on-point questions, because what I really realized is that the story was always the same. What I had to grow in my courage and in my ability to know what the story was and to say it without shame. And so I've had to grow past shame and in boldness. And so one of the beautiful things about the internet is I've been able to write pieces for various publications that are online. And so as I've published pieces here, pieces there, I won an award last year. And the piece ran in a literary magazine called The Ninth Letter. Well, it ran online, and so anybody could Google me and read that. But that piece really is a distillation of everything the memoir is about. And so once I won this award, and I, you know, it was a 25-page piece, it's like, wow, okay, this is what I'm really working with now. And so as I've published more, and I've grown slowly and published more and more about it, each time it becomes easier and easier. And also the world has changed around me. You know, when I began this, the idea of a black president didn't seem realistic, you know. Then, of course, when we got our first African-American president, then he pushed forward initiatives that made life easier for LGBT people. And so it's all been kind of a nice, the time has been really good. It's like as my ability to write the story has evolved, the social context of what I'm writing about has changed. And so I feel it's much easier to write about this now. We have openly gay and lesbian actors and athletes, and so it feels like it's a whole different thing. It's still very loaded to talk about it from a religious point of view, but I've had 20 years to kind of meditate on it and kind of distill it. So yeah, it's not been easy, but time, I think, because I tell people I'm primarily an essayist. And an essayist is sort of working through thoughts. And so I tell my students, you know, if you're writing an essay and you think you know what it's about, then there's no room for discovery. And so I have allowed myself the space to discover what it is I'm writing about and to keep fine-tuning it. So I think that's what's happened. I think my boldness has grown over time. You know, I'm going to be 50 this year, so, you know, now is the time.
Absolutely. So you describe yourself as a spiritual person, which I'm assuming, having grown up in the Pentecostal church, this means you're not necessarily associated with a church anymore.
That's correct.
How do you just, so can you tell me like a little bit about how do you define spirituality for yourself?
Okay, so you should be working for the national media. These are great questions. So
thank you.
So what I realized, because I, you know, we started out as Baptists, and then when I was 15 years old, I thought, well, these Baptists, these people are really hypocrites. I really want the real thing. And so I think I always associated the kind of explosive dancing and singing and the loud music of the Pentecostal church as what was a real authentic spirituality. But over time, I began to realize that spirituality is something that happens within, and that religion is an outward thing. And so over the years, I've investigated many, many philosophies. I was a Buddhist for a while. I've done many, many things. So in the final analysis, I realized that my time alone in a room with my eyes closed is as much spirituality as it is when somebody steps on my toe at school. Like, it's all a part of the same thing. And so, you know, when I look at the life of the central figure of the Bible, of the New Testament, Jesus, he was never really in churches all the time. He was never really following, like, the laws, the rules of his day. He was always an outsider. People always thought he was crazy. They thought he had a devil. Something was wrong with him. He was this man's a hypocrite. He's with harlots and prostitutes. So I really believe that spirituality and humanity really go hand in hand. And so for some people, that manifests in a church. For others, it means reading books and quiet time alone. Fortunately, now because of the internet and because of podcasts and so much material online, I get quite a bit of spiritual nurturing from various spiritual teachers of all shapes and sizes online. And so, you know, I'm not a follower of dogma. I think love, joy, and peace are the ultimate arbiters of spirituality. People have no more spirituality flowing through them than they do love, joy, or peace. I think those are the three things. Mm. Anything beyond that is useless. Dogma aside. Mm. So that's sort of my.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I really think that's really very beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
So you are talking to me today from Buenos Aires?
That's correct.
Is that where you are?
I am. I'm in my apartment in Buenos Aires. I've been here for about, so at my university, I work at Park University, and so when we get tenure, we have the option to use some of the funds that the university has. And we can go out of the country, and they'll subsidize it. So I'm sitting in an apartment that my university is paying for in Buenos Aires, because I live in a small town in Indiana, and they know that we need to get away to refresh ourselves. So I've been, you know, we've had difficulty trying to schedule this because I've been on the road so much. But, you know, in August, I'll be back in Indiana for a long time. So I want to have collected many memories before I'm sitting back in the classroom with students.
So you've been there. How long have you been there now?
So I arrived in Buenos Aires on January 6th. So it's been a little bit more than a month. I'll be here to the end of March. Yeah. So it'll be about 3 months.
End of March.
That's right.
And are you working on your memoir during this time?
I am. Yes. I'm actually there's a really nice Starbucks. I know it's a shame to be in another country to be working at Starbucks. But it's a really nice Starbucks not over here. But they have really, I'm 6'4", so I like tall workstations. And the other coffee shops just have tiny workstations. Yeah, so I go just about every day, and I sit there and I write for a few hours a day. And I'm waiting to hear from the agent so we can go over the next draft. So yes, my Spanish is, I speak what I call survival Spanish. I can order from a menu, I can hail a taxi, I can get around. But I'm not really fluent. So I'm using my inability to speak Spanish as a way to kind of sequester myself away from everybody so I can focus on my writing. Because I have another In 6 months, classes will start. So I would like to either have a chunk of it ready or have a contract in hand. I need to come back with something in hand to prove that I've not just been gallivanting around the globe.
It sounds wonderful. It sounds like the, you know, the ideal writer's life that everybody envies and dreams about.
Well, I have to say, it's been pretty nice. You know, I live with a lot of anxiety about getting the book sold now because I think we're so close. And so I think I'll feel really like mission accomplished once she sold it and the contract is signed. Then the journalist will kick in and then the deadline will be there. So I'll have to get it finished. But right now, yeah, it's been nice. It's been, I spent 6 weeks in Europe last summer. I spent some time in North Africa. I spent 2 months in Mexico. And so I'm a person who is deeply impacted by locations. And so I find that if I'm in another location, it really inspires me to think big. And I can also contextualize my life in a way that I can't when I'm sitting in the Starbucks in Indiana.
And I wonder, you can tell me if this is true for you, but I often imagine that if I had an opportunity like that, it would allow me to focus so intently on my writing because I'm away from the personal responsibility that I feel toward just managing my everyday life.
No, it is so true because initially what I thought I would do, I thought I would stay in the town and just not go to campus and just, you know, work at the Starbucks. But I kept running into people. They would sit down and start talking to me, what's going on. And so people who, you know, former students of mine who would see me, when they see you at Starbucks, they want to start talking because I was their professor. So I can't just say, well, go
right.
I want to say, you can talk to me. And so it's absolutely true. I mean, I'm writing about some really deeply traumatic events. And so there's something about being away from my own country and having to stare at this that, you know, I spent some time here in tears writing this material because it's really, really deep stuff. And so I think being away allows me to really contextualize it and to kind of go deeper into feeling than I would at home. It's a strange thing, you know, and it, you know, fortunately I work for a place that enables me to do this because not everybody has this option.
Right. Right. Well, you're very lucky. So I'm glad to hear you're taking advantage of this opportunity, and I can't wait to see the product. I'm really intrigued by the concept of the memoir and going to get it as soon as it's available, for sure.
Well, thank you.
So let's, I just want to wrap up real quick. And the last thing I want to know is where can folks find you online?
Okay. So my name is Samuel Autman. That's SamuelAutman.com. I have a .com space. And I use my first and last name on Instagram and on Twitter. So in all those places, I'm available.
And Instagram is where you're posting really beautiful pictures of your travels.
People seem to really like them. Yes, it's been really, really fun.
Yeah. We get to live vicariously through your gallivanting.
It's been really, really fun. But, you know, the schedule of courses has come out. I've been emailing my department with course names, and I'm having to work on my syllabus for the fall. So it's coming to a close. I can feel it, you know. It's like, but, no, it's been really, really a fun time. And I just hope that by August to have a contract. That's my main goal. If not a contract, a very sellable manuscript. So, no, it's been really fun. So I've appreciated the opportunity to talk about it. And I also want to thank you for Under the Gum Tree. Under the Gum Tree was the first literary magazine that ran a longer piece. I had other pieces published in smaller places, but your publication was the first that was what I would consider a peer-reviewed place that took a longer piece of mine. So I really appreciated that piece on Donna Summer. That was really a lot of fun. So thank you.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. And thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Hey, you take care. I'm glad we're able to do it. You take care of yourself, okay?
That was Samuel Ottman joining me today from his sabbatical in Buenos Aires, Argentina, South America. If you want to see some envious pictures of his escapades, find him on Instagram at Samuel Ottman. He's also on Twitter by the same handle. And you can also find out more about him on his website, samuelottman.com. Next time on More to the Story, I talk with another Under the Gum Tree contributor who's also a journalist turned creative nonfiction writer. I'll talk to you then.
To subscribe to this podcast, go to itunes.com/moretothestory. And while you're there, leave a review. I love feedback, I love hearing from you, and it helps with the ratings. More to the Story was produced out of my home office in Sacramento, California, with technical and audio support from my brother, TJ Santoro. Jeremy Marin, yes, my husband, he wrote and performed the theme song. You can find us online at moretothestorypodcast.com. Follow Under the Gum Tree on Twitter at @UnderGumTree. I'm Jana Marlise Marin at Just Jana on Twitter, Jana Marlise everywhere else. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you soon on the next episode of More to the Story.
Tell me a story. Tell me true. I want to know what happened to you. The stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell mine to you. On the balcony, drinking up our wine, talking about the way that we used to live our lives. The words in the books, man, they're nothing but lines. I look into your eyes and you look into mine. You say, tell me a story, tell me true. I wanna know what happened. The stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell mine to you.